if we think that the skill set that brought us here is the one that will keep us relevant in the workplace, then we'll have problems. And education's not helping. Corporate trainings are not really helping. And so it becomes a very individual decision, and it really depends on the sense of urgency that each one has.
Welcome to Modern Business Operations, where we talk with leaders about how ops is adapting to our modern world.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to another episode of Modern Business Operations. My name is Sagi. I'm the CEO and founder of Tonkin. And today I have the great pleasure of hosting Andrea. Hey, man, how you doing?
All great, Sagi. Glad to be here.
Well, thank you for joining me today. There's a lot of things I want to jump into. A quick overview of your kind of recent career. You're the author of an upcoming book, Between You and AI. I want to talk about that. Very, very, very timely. But you're also used to be the head of Tinder Latin America and the chief digital officer of L'Oréal Brazil. And you write a lot of things for a lot of different, known magazines, and you do a lot of keynotes. And so there's a lot of things I want to, jump into, but maybe we start, overview who you are. How did you get to do all this stuff? And maybe kind of like a short timeline.
Sure, Sagi, it will be a pleasure. I mean, my name says it all. I'm Italian originally, but I've spent 10 years in Brazil, where I actually kicked off my professional career. I'm an economist by education, but I've never worked with that. I actually pivoted to, of course, business, but especially technology. I was the first employee of Tinder, the dating app that some of the listeners know about, or maybe we can share some tips and tricks now, maybe towards the end of the episode, Sagi, right? We'll see whether that's interesting to them. But jokes aside, I was the first employee of Tinder in Latin America, and then scaled the operation for 5 years. We took it to, become the top grossing app on the App Store in Brazil, Argentina, and Mexico, and a number of other smaller countries. But I was also the chief digital officer at L'Oréal Brazil. And in parallel to that, I started doing some keynote speaking, which eventually became my main activity over the last 5 or 6 years. And in parallel to that, again, I write for a number of publications such as the MIT Technology Review and the Wired magazine. And again, this book is coming out in November called Between You and AI, which is about the skill set for professionals and leaders to thrive in the age of intelligent technology, and we'll talk further about that. But on a side note, I'm a black belt in Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu because life is not only about work. I'm based out of Miami, and here we are. It's such a pleasure being here, Sagi.
Awesome. No, thank you for that. Hey, Jiu-Jitsu, that's actually interesting. I'm wondering how much that impacts your philosophy of life. But maybe let's double click, into the book. I interview a lot of folks from all different areas in this podcast. And obviously in the last year and a half, every conversation very quickly ends up talking about AI. Even if in the pre-show we say we're not going to talk about AI this time, it kind of ends up talking about that too. And I think there's a divides between, excitement and fear, and everyone has a little bit of both, different percentages. Maybe with that, what is this book about? What got you to write it, and what are you covering it?
So basically, Sagi, as much as you've said, as soon as AI started to basically become, of course, massively used, especially with the launch of ChatGPT, its first version around 2022, I started reading a lot about it. And most of the books, actually all the books that I was reading, were books focused on the technological aspect of it. Of course, many also on the business aspect of it. But I wasn't really finding any book that was talking about the human aspect of it. Of course, some would be touching upon the impact, AI has on the job market and on the future of work. But I was really intrigued by the impact it would have on our human skill set, and especially which new skill set would it require for, from successful professionals. And because of the fact that, again, after my career in tech, I started to dive deep. Maybe the fact that, I'm an economist by education really helped on that, because actually, my field of expertise is behavioral economics, which Daniel Kahneman, Dan Ariely have been popularizing over the last years, but really focuses on the behavioral aspect and, human skill set. I merged the two things, and I really started doing research and, of course, writing on this unique intersection between AI And so mapping out what AI does better than humans, but really in detail, getting to see, for example, whether humans or AI is better at adaptability, which is something we can further talk about, and where humans are much better than AI. Of course, also focusing on what AI does best, which is substituting and learning on the very repetitive tasks and the familiar tasks where you have basically a measurable outcome, because then you can feed data into the AI and AI learns, which actually take up around 40% to 50 or maybe even more percent of our daily tasks. And so that's where a lot of people are scared, because they'll be like, okay, then I'm going to be substituted. No, a chunk of the tasks that we perform are going to be substituted. And the problem is, though, if we don't compensate that with a whole new set of tasks, then we will become more and more worthless in the job place. So I focus around three big pillars of transformation, what I call the cognitive, behavioral, and emotional. And within them, I lay out 9 new skills that become more and more important in the age of artificial intelligence.
So that's, again, very timely. Let's maybe half a step back. Do you think it's, aside from writing these books, you obviously believe in this, the importance of this, but how much do you think the hype versus not hype? Do you think this is really what it's set to be? Do you think we're overexcited? How do you rate the reality versus potential?
So if we look at the recent stats, and we're recording this now mid-September 2025, and truth is the latest numbers are not really reassuring on the actual impact. So pointing to sort of an AI bubble or hype, which doesn't mean the technology is not transformative, but which might mean that, valuations out there are super high when it comes to the startups and the investments. Also, the corporate projects, seemingly, according to an MIT Media Lab's recent report, 95% of, AI projects actually fail. But the interesting part of it is that I even think that maybe this overhype is actually good, because it does a number of things. First of all, it points to the things that we're not doing right through the adoption. And again, when we look at the reasons for failures of many of these projects are, first of all, because the companies that use the tech tools do not have the data ready. And so it's bringing a spotlight on the, data readiness, AI data readiness of companies. Second, which is a topic you guys are very big experts on, is the operations and processes are not in place. And the third big aspect is, again, getting back to the topic of my work, is the human aspect of it. There's not enough training, out there, or at least the training is too technical and too little behavioral. And the consequence of that is that many of these projects fail when it comes to the measurable impact of them. And so, there's this theory that's called the bullshit job theory. And sorry for that. I don't know whether I can say it, but I know I can. But it says that basically, and it is actually corroborated by a more academic theory, which is by Darren Acemoglu, the simple microeconomics of AI, which says that basically AI came to make more productive jobs and tasks that were already very unproductive. And therefore, the real productivity gain of AI is not that real, because those tasks and jobs were very unproductive in the first place. So I think, yes, getting back to your question and wrapping it up, there's a lot of excitement, maybe also too much, which points to a potential deflation of a bubble. But as much as that happened with the internet, in the 2000s, I think that might be actually good for the technology.
Yeah, I like it to kind of finish with the internet, because I was about to go there too, right? There's a clear distinction between whether the market is overfuming with excitement, and whether or not this technology wave is going to be transformational. Like the dot-com boom was one of the probably biggest one. Yet, 25 years later, to think that, or even 10 years after that, right? But now 25, we have the ability to look back 25 years and everything is different. Like there's not even one aspect of our life that is not different because of the internet. The cars are using internet, so it's like everything is using internet. And so I like that comparison a lot. Let me double click though on that last point and kind of like further into the area of work you kind of cover in the book. I do think that, you know, similarly to that internet revolution, whether you believe the AI revolution is happening right now, will happen only in 10 years or anywhere in between, right? It's very clear that some things will change, and it does feel like, and I really kind of really stood out for me, the 9 skills concept, that there's actual, that humans need to now really look inside of where we need to be better. So let's expand on this a little bit. Well, like, what are the key findings there? Obviously, as an introduction to the book and the concept from a high level.
That's perfect. I mean, Sagi, basically, whenever we look at the comparison between the way that humans work, you know, namely on a cognitive aspect, on the task execution aspect, and on the sort of like social aspect, there's many differences between the way that AI works with respect to our human brain and the feelings also that we have. And so whenever we map out, first of all, on a cognitive level, AI has a very high degree of substitution when it comes to human abilities. The thing, though, here is that what becomes more and more important on a cognitive aspect is the ability to ask questions. And that gets a little bit into the prompting space, which, again, oftentimes the outcome of an AI tool is as good as the question that you ask it. And so that's the whole prompting ability, which is one of the skills on a cognitive level that I talk about. The second one is what I call data sense making. It is how well do we understand the data that we have at hand, and how critically are we able to evaluate an AI output, whether it's a result of an hallucination or not, whether it's biased or not, whether it is a consequence of a generalization problem, and so on. There's this great quote by Carnegie Mellon professor Paul Shenlow that says that we shouldn't just teach kids to solve their homeworks, but actually to, you know, grade the homework, which means, you know, we need to be more critical. And now part of the big problem that we see within companies and organizations is that we have a workforce that copies and pastes, you know, Gen AI tools and, you know, just without any level of critical thinking, and ends up spreading hallucination and biases and so on. And that's a great risk. And the third cognitive skill that I talk about is actually reperception, is the ability to update our thinking in face of new information. And reperception is more and more important because AI is accelerating the rate at which things that were up until a couple of years ago impossible, possible now. And so our mind, though, is being, because of heuristics, programmed to actually, again, build up beliefs, because it makes our decision-making faster and more efficient. But now we need to also not, or just to be able to make decisions, but also to give up our past decisions. And that's reperception. And then maybe, you know, quickly on the other two pillars, on the execution, what I call the behavioral pillar, I talk about adaptability. I talk about augmentation, which is very much related also to the operation aspect and to the work that you guys do at Tonkin. We can further talk about maybe augmentation. And anti-fragility, which is the ability to learn through mistake. And last but not least, on the emotional pillar, I talk about empathy, trust, and agency. The ability to take responsibility, this last one, to take responsibility for AI's outcomes. Which, again, especially in a world where AI is not deemed responsible, or neither technically nor legally nor morally, we humans have to take responsibility for the AI tools we use, develop, and adopt. And so I think it's, you know, a very quick summary of what are some of these skills. And of course, we can touch upon some of those more in depth.
Well, I agree with every single word you said. So already sounds like a wonderful book, and I'm definitely planning to go deeper. I have a couple of questions as you were going through it. We can talk a lot about the practicality of bringing this now, but there's something you mentioned that actually is maybe further out, but actually very intriguing to me. you talked about critical thinking, you talked about the ability to grade, and even the example you gave with the quote about the homework and the kids. You know, whether you argue that the 95% failure rate that the MIT study found is going to be different next year or not, we can talk about that. What I think is very critical, I have two young kids, you know, below five. There's no way that, you know, their future is going to be, the future when they get to work is going to be similar to what it is right now. Definitely. In many ways. And so how far, and the reason I was laughing to myself is you mentioned critical thinking and grading homework. It feels so archaic the way that schools are being done now. And people talked about it for a long time, but now it becomes even ridiculous a little bit thinking about what my kids are studying in school right now versus what they actually need to study. What do you think? What do you think in that?
On that, I mean, area? So yeah, I think, you know, like I'm an expecting father, so I don't know in practice. You have two kids, so I will know soon by December when I'll have my first. Basically,
congratulations, by the way.
Thank you so much, Sagi. But I totally agree with you because, to be honest, the classroom hasn't really changed since I was a kid. Or, you know, some schools are testing out new things. But overall, let's make an example about this first ability that I've talked and I've, you know, studied and mapped out for the book that, again, is prompting. But prompting goes much beyond just the ability to write specific and context-rich prompts to an AI tool. Is the ability to actually shape better questions, even to other humans, not only to AI. Let's go maybe, you know, to the classroom. When I was a kid and nowadays as well, we are actually being graded by the quality of our answers, mm-hmm. not really by the quality of our questions. I recall when I was being a kid, I was always curious, but actually school killed my curiosity because anytime I would raise a hand in the middle of the class, my teacher would say, Andrea, this is not so important now. Let's talk after. This question really is not appropriate now or doesn't really make sense. And so it kills the creativity and the curiosity of kids. And therefore, our ability and actually the frequency studies show the frequency of questions. I don't know how old are your kids. You've said they're both under five. So maybe the older is already asking a ton of questions, right?
Oh, yeah.
Always about the why of things and how does
both
this
of them.
Work?
It's very early. Like since right? they start talking, they almost, you know, people talk about, you know, mama, baba, papa, all that stuff. The real significant word is why. Why,
exactly.
why, yeah.
And it's funny because when we're adults, especially in the workplace, we end up never asking that question again because we think we already know the why and we, you know, again, we think we already have the answers because we've been programmed in a way where basically the best leaders, you know, are the most experienced one with, you know, the more years within the company and usually they're the most knowledgeable. But in a world where AI does not only overcome our ability to have all the answers, but it also updates its repertoire much faster than us, then it becomes a problem because not only we're competing with AI, but we're competing with anyone else that has its knowledge democratized by the access to AI. And so I don't have a legal education, but if I know how to ask good questions, again, not only to AI, but also to other specialists, sometimes I'm able to actually have a more in-depth understanding of maybe a legal intricacy than a generalist lawyer that has studied overall law for 10 years. And so then it puts a lot of pressure again on education, getting back to your point. And maybe the last provocation when it comes to this is, you know, it's so hard to forecast which jobs might be, you know, in more high demand in the future. So it's hard to actually shape education based on that. But maybe a hint comes from a recent interview. I don't know if you've seen that, but like by Geoffrey Hinton, the godfather of AI and also Nobel Prize winner in physics in 2024. And they asked him this, like, you know, in 2035, what would make me have a job? And he said, well, study to become a plumber. And he was half joking because he said AI is not as good with spatial and physical manipulation than us humans. But, you know, besides this joke, which was not a joke because Microsoft made a report with the top 40 professions by 2035, and I think phlebotomists was number one, and nurses and so on were up there in the ranking, even you know, jobs that, you know, they're very niche nowadays. You know, to wrap it up, there's a seed of the answer to your question in there, which is we need to carefully understand what AI does better, because it's not only that it makes us compete with AI, but it democratizes access to that skill to everyone else. So the skill goes down in demand, well, because there's oversupply of it. And so we need to identify what are the new skills. And I think part of the book is related to that.
This episode is brought to you by Tonkin. Tonkin is the operating system for business operations, providing businesses with the building blocks to orchestrate any process with no code or change management required. Contact us at tonkin.com to learn how you can build complex processes fast.
I completely agree. I think asking the question, you know, even if you go to the Hitchhiker Guide to the Galaxy, right? It's like the answer is 42. And what? Well, you're asking the wrong question. And so, you know, I think that's true. I also agree with the last point you made of, at the end of the day, it's not even about what AI would do or not do. It's about what skills are going to be in hot demand. I want to talk about some of the other things you mentioned, because I do think they're overlooked. I really, you know, lean towards couples. One, you talked about the responsibility or accountability. I think that's a big one. I want to expand on that. And the second one was sort of like the part where it's, I forgot the word you used, but it's connections to how we work as people and how you kind of bring this as part of the process.
Perfect. So I use the word augmentation, and maybe I'll start from that because it's very much related also to the way that we look at our own workflows. So that already getting into the sort of realm of operation, we need to look at two big things that AI does when it comes to human tasks. It can either automate them, namely substitute the need for the human intervention. And that's basically where we always look at, you know, that's usually the short answer to what can AI do. It can automate tasks, and that's for sure. But it's also not only related to AI. This is much older than the recent hype of AI. What's often overlooked, especially by non-specialists, is the impact it has on actually not just substituting tasks, but enhancing the quality and the scalability of human tasks. And that's augmentation. And it's very important to make this distinction, because if we only think about AI substituting human tasks, that's where we will have that pessimistic outlook that AI is coming to substitute us. But whenever we understand that, if we automate the repetitive tasks first, we free up time to actually focus on unsubstitutable skills, but also on the augmentation aspect of it, which is, okay, how can I use AI to enhance my human work? And I'll give the example of actually Brazilian fintech that actually became the most valuable bank in Brazil, overcoming all the big traditional banks. It's called Nubank. It's actually listed in the US stock market. It's a great success story of a bank that was born digital. It still is digital, but reached a huge valuation. What they do is, when in their customer care, in their, you know, operations, they actually decided not to substitute the touch points with the customer with a chatbot, because that would be automation, pure automation. They decided to empower their human call center people with a panel, AI powered, where as soon as someone gets in touch with them, they get, first of all, the whole history of that person with the bank, projected reason of why this customer is getting in touch. So it shows up in the panel. Look, I think there's a high probability that they're getting in touch because of a glitch that we had in the app. So the person is already prepared to the problem. And last but not least, it makes, you know, suggestions of what the answer should be. So it doesn't take away the need of human attendance. It actually amplifies the quality of their responses, but also scales them. And so makes one of these human beings like much more productive, which of course eventually points to some substitutability, because you will not need 10,000 people, but maybe you will need half of it. But at the same time, it still focuses on the human as a, you know, with AI as a co-pilot, and not definitely as AI just as the pure solution. And, you know, just to wrap it up and go into what it might, how it might impact people that are responsible for operations and workflows is we have to become curators of our own workflows, mapping out the automatable tasks, mapping out the augmentable, and understanding what's the time saved that we get out of that. And I think that really what will make a difference in the future job market is what we do with the time that we get back. Because if a salesperson that now automatizes a lot of the invoicing and proposal quotations and so on gains time back, but what will make them stand out with respect to all of the other salesperson that also gain time back is how well they use that to create ties with the customer, to think strategically, to ask better questions and so on. So I think it will become something more and more important that we look at our job descriptions and we say, how much of this is, you know, potential to automation? How much of that can be augmented? And it's our responsibility, actually, and leaders' responsibility within the companies.
Look, I think, you know, as a CEO, I can say it, but honestly, it's true for anyone, you know, just observing of nature. The energy is not going to waste. If you were able to save time or to save effort, it always goes towards investment. Yes. Anyone that thinks that, you know, you cut cost, if you're able to cut it from 10,000 people to 5,000 people, then what the company would do is just fire 5,000 people. You just don't know how business works. If I can do it with 5,000 people and I have 10,000 people, I would want to do double the stuff versus, you know, doing half the stuff. It just doesn't make sense, right? And so I think a lot of people that are seeing the pessimistic side of it are either have an agenda or they don't have the experience to know kind of like what's important. But I think on a personal level, you know, other than buying your book, which I do encourage everyone to do, what are the things that you'll be like, this is, if there's one thing that every listener should do personally to really understand, because I'm in the belief that this change is coming whether you like it or not, right? It's just happened. It's going to happen. It happened before. It's going to happen again. We can argue, we can discuss, we can debate the implication and the timing of it. I don't think there is a question of whether it's coming or not. So now what can you do to your, like you said, to yourself, to your employees, to your kids, you know, what it is out of the nine, what is the one thing that if you do not master by the time that this becomes norm, you are definitely behind?
That's a great question. So it's like the million-dollar question. And in a way, it all starts from asking yourself, how do I get back to differentiating myself in the workplace in a world where, again, it's not only me adopting AI, but it's everyone else as well within the company and in the job market. And it gets back to that productivity paradox that I've talked about before, which is as much as in the Industrial Revolution, before that, I might have been, you know, better because of physical strength or, you know, I was good at operating machines or maybe, you know, I was very resistant while building railroads. Well, then mechanical innovations came and democratized access to strength and resistance. And it actually asked for more cognitive skills as a differentiator. We now live in a world where the cognitive skills are being commoditized again. And the access, as much as, you know, it's a comparison, but of course, it's a much niched one with the calculators in the 80s, right? Calculators democratized the outcome to someone who didn't know much about mathematics could have the same result than someone with a PhD in arithmetics. And it's sort of this at massive scale. And so whenever we think at what differentiates us, we need to, again, look at our own workflow and or to our own skill set and be able to critically understand that we need to focus on what AI is not able to do and what AI is not giving access to everyone else. And so that's why, again, it gets back to some of the jobs that are much more in demand, are going to be much more in demand in the future, are jobs that only few can perform today. Again, as mentioned by, you know, plumber, because not only they require a very specific knowledge, but also they require a very specific ability to apply that knowledge. And I think that's maybe getting back to some of, you know, the nine skills, I would point to the adaptability as being one, because there's something that AI is not able to do is actually adapting itself, especially to a spatial environment. There's this coffee test that was proposed by Steve Wozniak as a test to measure artificial general intelligence, right? Actually, the, you know, AGI is where everyone's putting their money now. Meta wants to build one and so on. And Steve Wozniak said, well, if an artificial intelligence is able to get into someone's house, a house it has never seen before, find a coffee maker and make a good cup of espresso, then we reached AGI. And AI is still very far from being able to do that because it lacks adaptability on a spatial level. It lacks common sense reasoning. It lacks perception. That's where we have to move towards as human beings. And again, really being able to understand what it cannot do, but also what it does not provide to everyone else. Because that's also something, you know, that is tricky. We think, okay, well, AI is now empowering me to do this, but it's also empowering everyone else. So that is not necessarily the solution. And so the solution is going beyond and being one step forward.
My personal belief is that, yeah, this is correct, but it's a moment in time, right? Like the real world AI, you know, is also going to get improved over and over in, you know, with robotics and Tesla, what Tesla is doing and other things. I think we'll see a boom in that as well. What I really like, I think the nine that you mentioned are very practical for, especially for business, when you're kind of trying to think about, you know, where to apply it and kind of where, what the expectation should be. I really do think your first one is really kind of where it comes down to. It's like, who's like asking the questions? At the end of the day, it doesn't even matter. You know, but a lot of people ask me like, what is an agent versus not an agent, you know, all that stuff. When it comes down to it, the mission, the goal, the question, the query, the prompt, however you want to call it, someone needs to come and say, this is what I'm looking for. This is the, and this is the scope of it. And then here are some follow-up kind of questions and the way you kind of like talked about the critical thinking aspect of it. And that is a skill that it's not about the skill. It's that is the job. You know what I mean? In many ways, the calculator is great. But if you're trying to just learn how to do 4 plus 4, like using a calculator is cheating. It's not helping you with the goal of the assignment. But if you're trying to figure out whether, you know, a ball is going to fall and hit the, you know, in a certain angle, the ground, because you're not trying to learn physics, then calculating the numbers is not going to help you there. So you're going to use a tool for it. And that is a great example of just how all of human experience is already and just will continue to become more and more of that. Are you trying to be a barista? Then you're going to make your own coffee already today, right? Like you can grind your beans or you can buy them grind. There's market for both, right?
That's exactly the point, Sagi. It's exactly that. We need to understand that basically it's our own choice. You know, it gets back to how much are we willing to understand. Okay, first of all, you know, in the 80s, Carol Dweck, already in her book Mindset, said there were two types. One is a fixed mindset and one is a growth mindset. And the growth mindset that it, you know, believes that our skills and capabilities and talents and limitations are actually not set, not fixed, but can be changed, is truer than ever and more important than ever. Because if we think that the skill set that brought us here is the one that will, you know, keep us relevant in the workplace, then we'll have problems. And education's not helping. Corporate trainings are not really helping. And so it becomes a very individual decision, and it really depends on the sense of urgency that each one has. And, you know, I think more evident than ever. I think it's happening right now.
I love how at the end of the day, the things, you know, when what progress brings is just further mirroring the need of going back to, you know, core principle, first principle thinking and core questioning. This is fascinating, man. I think this is going to be very important, a very important book and topic for a lot of people. And I'm excited to see where this goes. Maybe as we wrap up, going back to all the changes you've kind of lived through, and obviously we didn't get the chance to go too deep to your experience with Tinder, L'Oreal, but, what is maybe an early advice you got in your career that helped you and, kind of worth paying forward?
Look, it's a funny one because, Sagi, it's more related to what I do now rather than these jobs that I did in the past at L'Oreal and Tinder. Because I remember, actually, before them, I used to work at Groupon. I don't know if you recall Groupon.
Of course.
Up to today is the fastest, unicorn, the company that became the unicorn the fastest ever. The problem with that is that it actually collapsed as fast as it became a unicorn. And that was because we didn't really focus on the customer experience. We thought that the value that was coming to the customer was based on the low price he or she would pay. And my understanding throughout my career, as much as then that I applied with Tinder and other companies, is that what I understood is basically that the KPIs that we look at within businesses oftentimes are the wrong ones. And we focus too much on the short-term ones rather than the ones that actually show the long-term value of our customers. And the Groupon experience that actually my boss, which went against the overall management, which was sell coupons, sell coupons, sell coupons, was like, pay close attention to what happens when people redeem their coupons. And I was actually noticing the long lines at the restaurants we were selling. I was noticing, that oftentimes you would go to the restaurant that they would give you that, last table close to the bathroom. And I started to realize that, again, it's not the measures that are related to your short-term success, but to how well you craft an experience now will pay off in the future. And oftentimes, this is not really profitable in the short term because you invest money and time in crafting these good experiences. And I think we did that well with Tinder. We were looking very much at, the usability of the app, the gamification, the retention, rather than just, the growth in downloads or active users. So I think that was an early tip, which is don't focus too much on the short-term KPIs, but look at the customer experience, which will pay off in the longer run through other metrics that we don't usually look at in our day-to-day. So I think that didn't work for Groupon, but it eventually worked in other aspects of my work and life. So
nice.
Yes.
Also, thank you for that. Well, if anyone wants to pre-order the book or chat with you and kind of like nerd with you on those topics, where they can find it?
Sure, Sagi. I mean, there's a website about the book, betweenyouand.ai. It's the title of the book under the .ai domain. Then available on Amazon, available on all platforms out there, or also on Wiley's. Plus, people, if they want to reach out to me, just independent on the book, it's andreaiotto.com or on LinkedIn, you can find me and let's have a chat. Definitely. You're getting your copy to your home. Of course, you're not buying one. So thank you so much for having me here. You're getting a personalized copy and anyone reach out to me across social media and my website, andreaiotto.com.
Awesome. Andrea, thank you so much, man. This was fun. And go get the book. I think it will be an incredible asset for people in this transition. So I appreciate you coming here, man.
Thank you so much, Sagi.
I hope you enjoyed this episode of Modern Business Operations. You can see the show notes and all of the resources mentioned on today's episode at tonkin.com/mbopod. Thank you for listening, and be sure to subscribe for updates on future episodes. And if you're interested in staying up to date on the latest in business operations technology, head over to tonkin.com.